Hey everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. I'm here with my guy, Aris Pina, CompuBox operator and fellow kind of fight historian, if you will. And we're here to talk about fight history, boxing history, and a little bit of true crime. We're following up on our episode about some Kronk fighters that we did a couple weeks ago, and should be a lot of fun. And Aris, how are you, man?
Everything's going good, man. Hope everyone enjoyed a long weekend. I just got back from Austin myself, so a little tired, but I'm really excited to do this episode. You know, there was a lot of good feedback from the last one that we did. We highlighted a lot of fighters from the Kronk gym that, you know, have been forgotten over the years, but their stories deserve to be told, and, you know, they were told. With that being said, we planned on doing a part two, actually, before we even did part one. But since it was, you know, gaining popularity, there was a lot of requests from listeners for two fighters in particular to really focus on. And those were two guys that were actually thinking about beforehand as well. So today's episode in the Kronk fighters, we're going to be talking about Ricky Womack, guy who almost made the 84 Olympic team, and just his life spiraled out of control soon after that. And according to a lot of people, and especially, you know, more so from everybody involved in the gym, maybe the baddest man to ever come out of the Kronk gym, Bernard Super Bad Mays.
Oh, well, actually, we were going to do Alvin Hayes.
Total. My bad, too. Yeah.
That'll be the follow-up.
So another one who had ties to the Kronk. Wasn't, you know, he was loosely associated with him, but I wouldn't say he was a complete member. Too Sweet Mays.
Yeah. Well, like I was saying,
and tongue twister over there.
Well, and also on top of that, right before we started recording, I had mentioned that we're probably going to wind up having to do like a couple of more parts after this, just because of how many. I mean, it's not funny, but because of part of the reason is because there's have been so many fighters that have gone through the Kronk gym, and that's part of the. I guess we had talked about it on that first episode. The magic, partially, the kind of double-edged sword of that magic, in that Kronk Gym was serving as a beacon in a fairly beaten-up community on the southwest side of Detroit. And nonetheless, because it had attracted so many people in a fairly beaten-up city and a beaten-up part of the city, that meant that there was going to be a fair bit of just kind of dirt and tragedy and whatnot that came with that. And so that kind of also accounts for the fact that we can get this mixed up fairly easily. But just getting back and recapping really quickly, Kronk Gym, for anybody unfamiliar, was founded in the 1920s. But as you can see right over Aris's shoulder, because this guy is the literal, like, he's the kid chocolate of vintage vintage boxing t-shirts. Got one for every year, every day of the year.
Every day of the year.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, for real. Not even joking. You might almost have that many. But Kronk Gym, over the last, it really came to prominence in the late 60s and 70s. And under the guidance of Emanuel Steward, it really rose to fame with a whole bunch of fighters in the amateur ranks around Detroit who are competing in a bunch of amateur tournaments and made a name for themselves as being hard fighting, hard training, just very skilled fighters. And Emanny Steward as a trainer and a manager managing a whole bunch of these fighters, et cetera. So it over the decades came to, it still has a name. It still is very famous. Even now, like you had mentioned, that Kronk episode that we did got a good bit of feedback because people still are very familiar with the gym.
I mean, it's iconic when you look at those
colors. It really is.
It's the most iconic colors in the sport. People just know that logo right there. It's been plastered everywhere. You know what I mean? It's associated. Like, even if you're just a fair weather fan of the sport and don't know too much, you've probably come across Kronk and seen that logo and seen it around. It's sold everywhere. It's still very, very popular today. The name alone, more so than the gym almost at this point, you know?
Well, and that's, it's like as a brand, you know, like it was very wisely branded. And also I think that kind of came under the managerial genius of Manny Steward, who encouraged his fighters not just to take care of themselves as fighters, but to also take care of their money and invest their money and try to take care of them with jobs and things like that. And so he obviously understood the value of something. And here we are, you know, several years after his death, still talking about Kronk as a brand and the importance of it. And so that's also, again, to emphasize at the beginning of this episode too, that we're not making fun of any of these fighters. We're not making fun of the situation. We don't think it's funny that any of these tragedies have happened, and we're not trying to cash in on it in any sort of way. But these are fighters that generally aren't going to be getting remembered overall otherwise. You know, these aren't extremely famous champions or something like that. Or in some of these cases that we've done the true crime episodes, they were champions, but just their story wasn't as well known, or what happened wasn't as well known, etc. So just to kind of throw that out there as a bit of a disclaimer right at the beginning.
Totally. And rightfully so, man. Like, these are stories that deserve to be told. You know what I mean? They all had dreams. They all had aspirations. Things fall on the wayside for whatever reason. We all have, you know, our demons that we have to get through. And like you said, it's just something that, like, it's interesting enough that, like, you know, they're not talked about enough because the Kronk name is so famous that, you know, certain fighters just got to take precedence over anyone else. And that's how it's usually going to be remembered, that, like, with these guys, it's, you know, it's up to us and other people, hopefully, to be able to tell their stories.
Yeah, it's really... Yeah, I wish that some of these stories were a little bit more well-known. But hey, I guess that's really what we're here for and what we're talking about today. Specifically, one of the fighters who really was getting asked for, getting mentioned in the feedback was Ricky Womack, a light heavyweight who, you know, like you had mentioned earlier, almost made the 1984 Olympic squad, you know, came really, really close. And one of the more prominent articles, if you do a Google on his name, is going to be kind of how his path crossed with Evander Holyfield's. And it's also a really good source of information, biographical information, you know, about Ricky Womack, for sure.
Sorry, I have neighbors that just moved upstairs that sounds like they're moving the earth around.
that's the magic of, you know, New York apartments.
I can't beat it. So, exactly. That's how I first discovered Ricky Womack. Pat, I'll ask you this. Remember in the Ring magazines of the 90s, one of the trademarks they'd have in each issue would be they do that photo, like photo guessing. Like, they'd have the thing, photo trivia. They had the photo up. Can you guess who this is? They give you the little description with some slight hints, but, you know, generally they're not going to give it away. And then you get ranked on 1 to 10, depending on whatever. So the first time, one of the first magazines I got, which was around 1995, the photo trivia that month was on Kronk Fighters. And Ricky Womack was one of them that was featured. It's just a little blurb. You just saw a photo of him, but it just, you know, that was it. But so I just kind of kept his name in my memory bank and didn't think much of it because I was still a kid. Fast forward, either later that year or the next year, my parents got me Phil Berger's Punchlines, Berger on Boxing. Phil Berger was a very prominent writer on and a great writer. I'm sure you would agree with that as well.
Definitely.
Who covered boxing back from, I would say, what, the 60s all the way until the 90s, up until his death, right?
Yeah, he was a very prominent. He was, like, when we talk about a different era when there were writers who were more dedicated to actually covering boxing, if not solely boxing, then, you know, making a real good living on actually covering boxing. He was among them for sure.
So one of his books, Berger on Boxing, was just a bunch of his bylines that he wrote over the years, you know, ranged on, like, really deep dives on Leon Spinks. I remember one on Nino Benvenuti, shows you how far back he went. Tyson Ruddock, a bunch of various names. But one of them that stood out for me as a very interesting one, and it was a long article, and just even as a kid, I still found it kind of fascinating, was the one that you just alluded to, Pat, was about Evander Holyfield and Ricky Womack. And I remember just reading, because I was a big Holyfield fan as a kid, so I was, you know, curious to read this, and so I'm reading it. And I'm hearing about this guy who was basically, like, in wrestling, Holyfield would be, like, you know, your typical babyface, John Cena, Hogan, whoever you want to consider him as. and Ricky Womack was the ultimate heel. You know, the brooding bad guy that he's always been feuding with for a long time is finally going to come to a head at some point. And that's how I took it. And that's why I was just like, man, I want to know more about Womack. But I couldn't. It's the 90s. You know what I mean? There was no footage on him. He has been in jail for a number of years at this point. So I had to wait until, you know, the internet age really came about that I was able in probably my high school, college years to really find out what was going on with him. But my God, man, what a fascinating story. And what, you know, what would you call it? Wasted potential. What if, whatever you want to name it, that was Ricky Womack.
It's a definitely, as we're seeing a recurring theme in a number of these true crime episodes, when we do have information about their childhoods, often it's it's stereotypically bad. Yeah. And it's sad. And that's not, I don't mean to laugh like, it's like a nervous laugh. I'm not laughing like, haha. It's truly, yeah, it's truly unfortunate. You know, Ricky Womack was born in 1961. He initially grew up in Jackson, Tennessee, but his mom took him, his twin brother, Mickey, and their seven siblings to Detroit after, his mom was shot by their father. And their father followed them to Detroit, and eventually the problems, the violence between their parents, led to the children, all nine of the children being placed into foster care. I mean, and like I said, it's extremely sad. And I'm trying to imagine being separated from your siblings overall, like in general, but then while being placed in state care, you know, it's not difficult to see how damaging that could be on a person during years when, you know, not to be like fucking Dr. Spock here, but like the children just need love and understanding. Yeah, and, totally. And not, you know, extreme inconsistency with their home life and stuff like that. So in any case, that's truly obviously setting these children up for a bad upbringing and a bad life. A rough life. It's a tough beginning. By the time Ricky Womack was 17, he was being sent to prison for armed robbery. And according to this article, prison psychiatrists were more or less saying he was kind of outside the reach of help. Like he was kind of like, no, like this kid's a cold. He's an asshole. Like he's responding like, you know, by being combative. He's not really cooperating or anything like that in the system. You know, he's like, that's it, you know, and he's just going to go through the system. And so by the time you're 17 or 18, basically being given up on, that's obviously not good. And that's probably going to affect your outlook. But in any case, Womack served 3 years during the stint for armed robbery. And after being released, showed some boxing talent. So he hooked up with Manny Stewart, who kind of took him into his home
and became a father figure for him, as Emmanuel Stewart was for many of those fighters from back in the day. Womack, you know, not to mention being taken to the ward at a young age, like the home life that he had already was like incredibly bad. You know what I mean? His dad was an alcoholic, other very, very hard issues, shot their mom early on. Womack and his brothers and the siblings all witnessed that, you know what I mean? And then after that happened, his mom took them all, left town, took off, and the dad followed them. Like that kind of happens in, you know, a lot of situations. More violence, more anger, more issues followed before finally, like you said, they were taken in. So Womack at that point, you know, he's already seeing more like a lifetime worth of like craziness that people can't even fathom. But like you said, Emmanuel Stewart, God bless the man. He thrived with people like that. That was his thing. He knew how to nurture these troubled souls, man. It takes a special person to be able to do that, to be able to gain the trust of people like a Ricky Womack or, you know, another troubled fighter that he'd be able to like handle or whatever it may be, like, and be able to nurture them and try to gain their trust and like guide them into a more productive life. And you know, there's going to be a lot of speed bumps along the way, but you're still able to do that, man. Stewart was that type of dude. That was his thing.
Yeah. We already did one episode talking about three fighters with trouble beginnings and issues that, you know, Manny Stewart had his hand in pretty much everything. just about all the fighters in the Kronk. Like he knew who they were, or, you know, some hand in recruiting them or at least training them. So that's what he, like you said, that was kind of his specialty. And according to a bunch of people, Womack was sometimes quiet and nice, but he could be really manipulative and childish if he didn't get what he wanted. And that article that you were talking about, where it opens up, like one of the first things that it says in that article was that Evander Holyfield claims that Ricky Womack walked over and stepped on his toe or stomped on his toe or something like that before their fight, to the point where Evander Holyfield was so upset by it that he was brought like to like frustrated or angry tears. And that some little kid nearby was like, look, daddy, you know, that man's crying, which is kind of like, I tend to believe a story like that because he's like not making himself look good in that story, you know. But in any case, things like that, it were just, you know, trying to abandon his
Imagine, first off, getting stubbed on your toe hurts like hell. We can all admit that. I don't care how tough you are. If you're the baddest man on the planet, you stub your toe, whether it's your big toe or your baby toe, your ass is going down. All right, it's happened to the best of us. And to walk over, your opponent at this point walks up, you're just sitting there minding your business, and a guy like Ricky Womack, I mean, if you go to his Bokrex photo, just look at it, he's intimidating as hell, and just stomps on your foot. What do you, and you can't really do anything about it at the point, and then he just kind of gives you like a fuck you look on top of it afterwards. That's a lot to handle to go into a fight, a lot to handle. Evander Holyfield is one of the most, like, you know, as we've grown to know him, man, like a person, like calm under pressure, just everything that he's handled his career, like he's always been like a very composed guy. For him to get unnerved is like to really, you got to do something to him. Ricky Womack.
Except for that one time where he bit an opponent in the amateurs.
Oh, that's right. wait, what fight was that?
I'd have to look at the opponent. I can't remember. But Evander. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was like the supreme irony in him getting bitten by Tyson was that he, he bit somebody else in the amateurs. I can't remember who it was. I'd have to look, but I'm not trying to argue with what you're saying. Like you're 100% correct. No. It's just,
but like, well, back to your point too, about Ricky Womack and his attitude. Another thing that they mentioned in the article, a thing that, you know, they noticed, like you said, he could be nice, you know, he could be polite and stuff like that. Emmanuel Stewart's wife took a liking to him. You know, he kind of looked at her, like he looked at Stewart as a father figure. He kind of looked at Stewart's mom as a mother figure. But things that started happening was when they would go on competitions, you know, in the amateur system and stuff like that, Womack would, I don't know, you know, just act out a little bit. Like, you know, they would go to places and things would get stolen.
Yeah, he'd just fuck off. Like,
he would just start slagging off and doing things. And when that happened, you know, like, eventually people would realize their shit got stolen. You know, X, Y, and Z, they find out it was him. And then 9 times out of 10, they said what would happen was Womack would walk up sheepishly, have his head down, walk up to the people and, you know, give the belongings back. But that was already troubling behavior. And then... I'll bring up one part of the article right here. It was while in Tokyo on an amateur competition, Womack and two other amateurs, Mark Breland and Steve McCrory. Mark Breland, obviously, maybe the greatest American amateur of all time, and Steve McCrory, who we've talked about in previous episodes, another Kronk alumni, and a fighter who actually went on to win a gold medal at the 84 Olympics. But we're in a store when a merchant showed him a wristwatch. Womack picked up the watch and walked out. Just picked it up and walked away with it, leading to Breland and McCrory being detained by police until, as Stewart recalled, the manager trainer could straighten out the man. And just things like that. Like, I've been around people like this in the gym too, like other little things. Like, you have, you know, because he was a bully. And, you know, Womack knew he was a big guy. He was a strong guy. And he was able to, like, intimidate other people because no one was, like you said before, no one really wanted to stand up to him. So if they be in the gym and he had his boombox the loudest, who's going to tell him to turn it down? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, like, I think that people know now that if you're on, like, an amateur team or a gym's team, every so often you might travel to, like, a different city, maybe even a different state. But back in the day, doing international travel for like a big team or something like that wasn't necessarily, you know, that wasn't that out of the ordinary. And so
all the time.
Like another incident they were talking about was that apparently when Womack found out that one of their events and then the Soviet Union wasn't being televised, he tried to leave and said that he wasn't going to participate because it wasn't being televised and all sorts of shit. So he was a baby. He was a gigantic baby. You know what I mean? Like I don't think it was so much a diva as it was just that he was, like he just wanted the things his way. And when they didn't go his way, he was just a jerk about it. And anyway, when it kind of started going downhill, according to Manny Steward, and you know, again, fairly believable in the situation, I think, was that he began dating a much younger girl and he started spending his money on said girl and just paying even less attention to the things people told him to do. And he was making good money. He, had really done well as an amateur. He was an amateur standout, nearly made it to the 1984 Olympics. Like you had said, he had come, within one win over Evander Holyfield making it to, I think it was the trials. And then from there, you know, he could have potentially gotten a spot on the Olympic team. But even so, even after not getting that, he signed a six-figure deal, a promotional deal when he turned pro. In the 1980s, six figures is still pretty serious. Even now, it's still pretty serious, you know?
In these six figures, I'd be hyped. But yeah, totally. In the 80s. Shit. As a pro fighter in the 80s, and you didn't make the Olympic team, because look at other standouts who almost made the Olympics, like Aaron Pryor. Look how he turned pro with nothing, absolutely nothing. So for Womack, like you said, to get six figures, and not on top of that, he got himself a car from Stewart put him up free lodging where he didn't have to pay for rent, and like he took care.
He was getting like an allowance and shit. He was getting taken care of
He was getting taken care of, totally.
Yeah, and that's another just kind of aspect of this that probably goes under the radar a little bit. And it's something that gets either forgotten about or overlooked, is that in a lot of these situations where a fighter is really high level as an amateur, I'm not like taking sides of managers and promoters and stuff like that, because, you know, 99% of the time I'm going to take the fighter's side. Mm-hmm. But even so, like in a lot of these situations, the fighter's literally like being paid to fight, even if they're not making money at, you know, during the fights, you know, like how are they living otherwise? You know what I'm saying? So a lot of the times the managers and promoters, the ones who can afford it, are taking care of the fighters. You know, that's just kind of historically how it's been. And again, that's just part of the story and part of the equation that gets forgotten about quite a bit. And Manny Steward did that for a lot of fighters.
Especially if the fighters, you want to make sure they're going to be on the straight and narrow.
You can't just be like, all right, now just, you know, come back tomorrow, but then I don't care what you're doing the rest of the time.
You gotta like go the extra mile that didn't take care of it to make sure all tracks are covered.
Yep. Well, and also I think that we've seen countless times among some of these true crime episodes, but probably some of the fighters, the Kronk 2, despite Manny Steward's efforts, they just didn't know what to do with the money. The money burned a hole in their pocket. They didn't know how to invest it, or even after being taught to do it, still wouldn't do it just because it just didn't stick for whatever reason. And so, yeah, dude, six figures in the 1980s, that's pretty fucking serious. He fought to a draw in his debut, which was probably something of an anticlimactic debut, but even so, it happens. You know, sometimes people lose in their debut or get a draw or whatever. But then he went on to win his next eight fights, going, you know, 8-0-1, which is a highly respectable record. I mean, 8-0-1, I'll take that record for any prospect, you know?
Especially in the 80s, man. I mean, and for a Kronk fighter.
Light heavyweight, you know, above middleweight. That's good shit.
No, it's not bad at all. And for a Kronk fighter, they're not being matched against absolute cupcakes either. You know, as you look in 1985, if you go to his, if you look at his record, he ends up fighting Uriah Grant. Uriah Grant at that point only had a handful of fights, but he ended up being a cruiserweight mainstay for a very long time. We mentioned his fiasco fight with Tommy Hearns, but before all that happened, he was a longtime contender, always gave everybody hell, and then actually briefly held the IBF championship in some point in the 90s. So,
I mean, you have to give it at least. And I know that, like, this doesn't mean anything because for the most part, like, they're undefeated with only a couple of fights. But mm-hmm. looking at the guys he fought, you know, 1-0, 2-0, 3-0, 3-1, 6-2. I mean, they're at least winning records. And I know that's like a fucking low bar here, dude. I know.
But again, we've discussed it too. But like with the different eras, these guys aren't like, most of them aren't like bums. And with the Krunk fighters, they were never going to be matched against absolute softies over and over. Stewart always wanted to make sure they're developed.
You go and you look at the vast majority of prospects now. And that's not to pick on fighters now. Even in other eras. And you look at the guys that they're fighting at, like, you know, their fourth, fifth, sixth fight, and they're not winning records. You know, like it's like a, you know, they're like 2-19 or some shit like that. You know, like they're fighters who know how to fucking lose. And anyway, there's a big difference between fighters who know
how to lose. Nothing like an opponent, and there's nothing else in sports like an opponent in boxing.
Yeah, dude, for like sure.
A professional opponent.
For sure. Although I will say there is a caveat here that in this like early 80s era, there is still in this time the potential for a couple of fighters to be fighting under like pseudonyms or some
exactly,
shit.
Exactly. Yeah.
So there is that is possible. Just throwing that out there. No, but 8-0-1, it's a good record. It's a very good record, especially for a light heavyweight. You know, you're talking about the success of Evander Holyfield at this time, who was, a lot of people might forget, at light heavyweight and, you know, bulked up from his pro debut onward. And on top of that, the 1980s, early 1980s, really hot for the light heavyweight division. Still just fucking red hot from these dudes we were talking about somewhat recently, Matthew Saad Muhammad, you know, Marvin Johnson, all these.
And at this point, too, around 1984, 85 that we're talking about, the division was kind of open. Michael Spinks had just moved up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? People were, like, clamoring now for that number one spot. And it wasn't like there was absolute killers there. Marvin Johnson had just reemerged. You had Leslie Stewart. Prince Charles Williams hadn't come on the scene. Bobby Chez was just rising. Like, there wasn't really anybody out there that was, like, overly, like, you know, like, overly killer right there that, to say, if Ricky Womack really decided to take his stuff seriously and really put full effort on it, that he could have made a big splash in that division.
Well, unfortunately, we had a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
In late 1985, it was actually December 30th, the day before New Year's Eve. Ricky Womack apparently robbed two Redford Township video stores. And at one store, he pistol whipped the clerk.
Yep.
And at another store, in the middle of his robbery, a customer walked in, and it's the way it was described kind of sounded like he freaked out and he shot the customer in the leg. Whether intentional or not, I have no idea, but either way, they've got a fucking bullet hole in their leg, so who cares? And so he winds up for this two armed robbery and also, I guess assault with a deadly weapon or whatever the charge was. I didn't see. Nonetheless, serves 14 years in Michigan State Prison, released in November of 2000 after several unsuccessful attempts at getting paroled. Former boxing commissioner Stuart Kirschenbaum actually picked Womack up from prison, and Womack's comeback was very quickly underway upon his release. Reports from earlier in his prison sentence said he had been separated from other prisoners for attacking them, for fighting.
Yeah, oh yeah, yep.
That he had gotten in a bunch of different trouble. But later on, supposedly he had found Jesus. He had been watching the 700 Club with that guy. I think his name's Pat Robertson.
Oh, oh boy.
It's a religious fucking abomination. Don't ever watch it. But in any case, he was watching this show, which is like an ultra like religious, like absolute crackpot fucking bullshit. Stuff
that was like really popular in the late 80s. I just remember seeing them all over the mm-hmm. place.
Yeah, they're crazy. And so he watched this show and apparently found Jesus. And
somehow.
I guess at some point during his prison stay, he became a quote unquote model prisoner, to the point that some of the guards at the prison gathered together to watch the first fight of his comeback in March 2001. So he fought from March to November 2001. He fought four times and apparently looked okay, if not pretty good in a couple of the fights. But he didn't really fight anybody that good. So I don't know how you gauge it. But like the reports were not super detailed. I found them. There were reports of his fights. They just weren't super detailed. They didn't really describe the action. They just said physically he looked good. And it was kind of some hyperbole about, you know, Ricky Womack is back. It's his comeback. You know, he's back, when obviously he was, in terms of age, well past it. But he was back at heavyweight. And so I think that that was probably a big factor. You know, the fact that he's back at heavyweight and definitely at his heaviest.
Still shredded, though.
Yeah, no question.
It's sad, man, because like you said, like right before he went to prison for the armed robberies, like he was a big spender. That was his thing. He was spending a lot, doing a lot of crazy things. And it, like anyone who goes out there and starts spending, like Broner, for example, you know what I mean? Before Broner thought he was Mayweather, before he really started making that Mayweather money, like you thought, he gets a few million and starts blowing it instantly and starts struggling.
It's like that scene in Dumb and Dumber where he's just like, here you go.
Here you go.
And it's like, you know, you're going to go fucking broke so quick like that.
And they said that's what happened to Womack. He had nothing. And by the time he got desperate and, you know, started resorting to his other things, that's when he started, you know, with the crimes that he ended up going to jail for. But after he gets out of jail now, right, it took a long time. Like you said, he got into fights. He did all kinds of stuff. He had a good team behind him when he got out. He was with a woman who he ended up marrying, who was very loyal to him. The person that was backing him, the manager that was backing him, like you mentioned. And they also got, and this is a pretty key component as well, James Toney's former trainer, Bill Miller, you know, a guy who went all the way back to the Ezra Charles age, is a very, very sage trainer, great mind for boxing. And at that point, still, you know, even though he's elderly, but still with it enough that he can be a key component for that corner. So he had a lot of promise. People were excited for him. Womack came out of jail looking ridiculous. I mean, probably even better than he did before he went to prison. Because, like, he was shredded from head to toe. And he, you know, he didn't look his age. Obviously, he was still preserved, and there was a lot of hope for him.
Yeah, he, you know, he at heavyweight, it's one of those things where it's kind of like the narrative is always, you're a punch away. Mm-hmm. If you have the punching power, then, you know, if you're remotely durable and you have the punching power, then there's a chance. You know, there's always that kind of Cinderella potential at heavyweight, even though, you know, we know the reality at this point. And like I said, he fought four times. So, I mean, I think that I vaguely remember people mentioning him on like message boards, but I'm not going to lie. I never like saw anything. I don't remember how, you know, he looked or anything. I just remember people mentioning it.
There was footage of YouTube. I don't know if it's still there or if you looked for it earlier today, but like there was YouTube footage of his comeback fight. One of them might have been his last one. Or something.
I'm not gonna lie, I didn't look. I should have.
But there was something though. I remember years. I'm not gonna lie. It's been a long. It's probably been years since I looked for it. But there was footage of one of his comeback fights on YouTube at one point. One of them did happen on an ESPN undercard, ESPN 2 undercard, because I think the whatever fight that was being televised, the guys looked out of shape, and Max Kellerman alluded to seeing Ricky Womack on the undercard.
Yeah, when I looked like a week ago and like, yeah, I didn't specifically look for the Chapman fight, but I saw the Holyfield Olympic box off, like up there, I don't think anything else.
Probably got taken down. Like I said, this was some years ago.
Yeah. So in November, 2001, that's the Willie Chapman fight. His final fight comes in at a career high 206 pounds. And it, like I said, wasn't really given much of a description, even in Detroit newspapers. It just wasn't really, it wasn't really mentioned a whole lot. And then on January 19th, 2002, Womack apparently committed suicide by shooting himself in the head. And that's according to literally the only report on it that I can find. That there were other reports that had mentioned him committing suicide, but not the method. And I'm not trying to get gruesome. I'm not trying to get detailed in that regard, but me, I am curious what happened. But there's not really much reflection as far as what anybody believes, or at least anybody close to him believed happened.
Yeah. What you said is probably correct. Is obviously, you know, what everyone says. He was depressed. You know, there's a few articles out there and things that mentioned that said he wasn't in a good place of mind, especially after it might have been the Chapman fight. I'm assuming it was the Chapman fight, that he was, his performance, he felt, you know, obviously, I think it was almost like he realized it wasn't going to be, you know, nothing was going to be the same. And he struggled in that fight. And he was always a person, like you said, he was like very sensitive, you know. And I think that he was like, you know, always worried. He was worried about the crowd. He thought people were making fun of him. He had all these other thoughts going in his mind. He was struggling. He was struggling out in the real world. He's trying to contain this and trying to go on with his career. But, you know, what he was able to do in the 80s before he went to jail, what he was able to do in the box office with Holyfield and, you know, compete at the highest level, the amateurs, it wasn't going to be the same anymore. And trying to do it as a heavyweight, as an undersized heavyweight at that, you know, in his early 40s, late 30s, early 40s, it was an uphill battle that he realized quickly though that it wasn't happening. And combining that with all kinds of other factors, trying to adjust out of jail and all this stuff, it unfortunately overwhelmed him. And it's sad because this happens to other people. And, you know, it's a tragic case because there were people out there who did care for him. You know, he had a whole support team after him and they were really doing their best to try to make it work. But sometimes these people, you know, people are just, you can't, it's hard to say, but like some people just, you can't save them. You know what I mean? And no matter what you do, but Womack had that support system behind him.
Well, and yeah, that's what's kind of like, you know, I don't really prescribe like destiny or fate or I don't really believe in that kind of stuff really. But at the same time, stories like his do kind of give compelling arguments for it because like you said, he came from a really bad place, but then was at some point kind of like there was intervention. There was some people stepped in and gave him what you would imagine somebody in that situation would need, and pretty much everything they would need, and at least financial stability and, you know, the idea that somebody cares about them and wants them to do well. But perhaps something just from that upbringing was broken at some point and it just couldn't be repaired. I don't know how it works, but it definitely is a sad case.
And it's too bad, man, because like I said, if he had really developed in the late as a light heavyweight after he got out of there, he probably could have made some noise. The division was wide open. Michael Morden wasn't going to come out for about a few years. Bobby Chez was talented, but he was obviously beatable. The champions around that time were all J.B. Williamson. You know what I mean? I'm just giving you an example of what we were dealing with at this point. So
yeah, that post, like the mid 80s was not the greatest time for light heavyweight. After that early 80s burst, it was like,
As most hot things go, like with the welterweight division, remember when you had De La Hoya, Trinidad, everything like that, and then like it kind of cooled off slightly. You had Mosley, but Mosley didn't really have competition until Vernon Forrest came around a couple of years later. And then it cooled off for a while. But like, same thing, light heavyweight division, after Michael Spinks kind of left, everybody was kind of scrambling, but no one was really dominant, you know, and it was kind of wide open. It's not difficult to
imagine he could have done something, yeah.
Totally, because after that, man, Virgil Hill became the dominant guy for a number of years, so. And Hill was from the same class as Womack. I'm sure they knew each other well.
They probably did, yeah, being among, you know, national and international amateur.
Totally.
Yeah. So it's definitely a sad case. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not like we're going to move on to a happy case. and Two Sweet
But
Haze.
I mean, it's but the and the one we're talking about was, well, what are we moving to right now?
Alvin Hayes.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not, and I'm not going to lie, it's not like we're all of a sudden going from sad to happy or anything like that, but definitely a different case.
A colorful.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure. Definitely a little bit more of a King of Pop type of case. Yeah. So I did find a little bit more biographically on Alvin Hayes than I think otherwise. So anyway, I'll go through some of the stuff that I found real quick before we get to his the stuff we know of his career a little bit more. He was born in 1958. But unfortunately, he had a fairly stereotypically bad upbringing as far as, like, when you think of somebody who's had a really shitty childhood, unfortunately, just kind of tick the boxes. He grew up poor on the east side of Detroit. His father was absent, and he was basically more or less allowed to run the streets. By the time he was old enough to, you know, he was acquainted with the juvenile court system. And he said he was actually shot in the back of the head once and shot at several times, and that on a separate occasion, he was shot at, and his girlfriend, and I think he said his cousin, were both with him and shot. And it sounded like everybody made it, because he didn't say they were killed, but I have no idea. The point is, there was a lot of bullets flying around, needless to say. But at 17... he was locked up for 4 years for violating probation and carrying a pistol. And I mean, you could, I guess, kind of see why he was carrying a pistol if people were shooting at him all the fucking time. But he started boxing actually at 21, when he had, right around when he'd gotten out of prison, and he'd already earned the nickname Too Sweet because, according to everybody, he was a good looking dude. And he was, you know, just kind of a flashy guy. And so he went to Kronk after he was released from prison. He said they didn't like him. He didn't like them. So he went to another gym, Brewster. Same thing. He didn't like them. They didn't like him. He wound up at a gym called Connor, C-O-N-N-E-R, and fought out of there as an amateur. But at some point, he joined the powerhouse gym in Highland Park, Detroit, and fought out of there for most of his early career. And so, like you had said, he was making good money early in his career and apparently had more money than I guess he was ever used to having at that point. And he used to enter the ring in a Michael Jackson outfit and a choreographed dance routine.
And dude, they have shirts. I want an Alvin Hayes t-shirt. It's out there somewhere.
You, right. Hear that? You hear that, boxing people? Eris wants that Too Sweet t-shirt.
That's out there, all right, man? All of his cornermen will wear it. It's a red one with like a whole outline drawing of it. It says Too Sweet Hayes across, and I need one for my collection.
Bad. There's got to be one out there.
Has to be. Somewhere out in Detroit, if there's any Detroit listeners who have any connections to back in the day to Too Sweet Hayes and his gang, find me that shirt. I'll pay you top dollar. Anyways, yeah. He a very, very colorful character for the time, all right? And during a time when being out there and colorful like that and, like, really just, like, pulling on a whole dance routine and dressing up either, like, Michael Jackson or, like, Zorro or whatever he would do was pretty much out, you know, was not of the norm.
You're going to get some old, white, grumbling commentators.
Well, all right, it's very rare footage, all right? You don't see, I mean, it's not on YouTube. I've never seen it on YouTube. A loyal listener of the show and a friend of mine, Martin S, superstar JNL that we've talked about before on the show from England, he has a copy of it. It happened on the Hagler Hearns undercard. And you know how those major pay-per-view shows, you like Leonard Hagler Hearns, like any of the Four Kings fights, no one ever really talks about the undercard because obviously everything's just talked about for the main fight. You can find some of the undercard fights on YouTube. They're out there. Juan Domingo Roldan was featured on all of them, on a bunch of them. Trevor Burbick, John Tate from the first Leonard Duran fight. Like, various fights are out there. The one fight that I've always wished a good quality, you know, footage of it was on YouTube, and it's never been out there, is Jimmy Paul against Alvin Too Sweet Hayes. Detroit against Detroit. Kronk, Jimmy Paul against Alvin Hayes and the gym that he was representing at the time, which was clearly wasn't Kronk. And you see all the cornermen.
Powerhouse, I think, at the time. Yeah.
Exactly. All of his corner men are wearing, you know, the Alvin 2 Sweet Hayes t-shirts that I desperately want. And they had the full-on dance routine. And Pat, like you just said, all these old crumb dungery white men are there complaining about it and going, what is he doing? How is he dancing like this? Do you think he can get away with this? And Brewster, no, what do you think about Fall River, Mass? Somehow they brought up Fall River, the small shanty town right next to my city where I grew up. I don't know who named it. Yeah,
well,
that.
What the fuck does that have to do with anything? What are you trying to suggest, you assholes?
Who would name drop Fall River in the 1985? What? Anyways, yeah. They were like, what about Fall River? Well, absolutely not. Probably not, because Fall River sucks, but yeah. So, sorry I'm going on like a little, but like this is exactly what it was. But,
yeah. I can imagine it.
But Hayes, Too Sweet Hayes, bro, goes on the full-on dance routine, like you said, man. It is incredible. It absolutely wipes away Anthony Hendricks, which he did a few years later. Like, he just had, because he has his trainer doing it with him, man. They go back and forth, the full thing, slap another thing. The guy actually takes his towel out and slaps him, and Hayes spins around with it, like on motion. Like something you see on Soul Train back in the mid-80s. It's beautiful shit. I absolutely loved it. And then he proceeds to get knocked absolutely smooth clean out.
And according to folks who were there or have seen it or have it, I don't know, but I've seen a couple of people say that it was like a fucking brutal knockout.
It was. Like I've seen a clip of it. Martin sent me a clip of it as well, man. He gets smacked. Like, when the Ring Magazine recaps it, you see photos of it. You see Hayes in his whole Zorro outfit beforehand. And this is why the announcers were getting them mad. Obviously, you know, this is the 80s. Everybody there is kind of like manly man or whatever you want to call it. But Hayes was wearing, I think it was like bright pink trunks with like red lettering and stuff like that. And they were just with a pink mask and the whole brigade going on. So they were just like, ugh. But yeah, you see a photo of him in a ring and then you see him laying there. And it's a normal photo that you've seen a lot of guys, like Sammy Serrano, for instance. Remember when he got knocked out by Yatsusumi Nakamura?
Oh, yeah.
And you're laying there, and then you just have your head up, and you got the most lost gaze look in your eye when you're just cuddling.
That's an incredibly brutal and underrated knockout, dude.
Very, very. But you know the face I'm talking about when yes. he gets knocked out, right?
He's just like...
Yeah. Completely shell-shocked.
Yeah.
And that's how Alvin Hayes looked when Jimmy Paul smoked him.
Rough. He was 22-0. I mean, like, he, you know, we're talking about Womack in the 8-0-1, and Alvin Hayes had gotten to 22-0.
And he was a popular attraction out there, man. And he didn't have bad guys on his name. Edwin Vera went was past it, but I mean, he smoked them.
22-0, and they're gunning for a title shot now. And 22-0, you're probably gunning for a title shot then at that point too. You know, so
22-0 today, you're already a two division world champion.
Yeah, if you're Lomachenko, you're 22-0, and you got like fucking 9 world titles under your
wrist. Yeah, already it's whole totally.
You've still fought nobody. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's 22-0. That's a very respectable record. I mean, obviously. Weren't a whole lot of great fighters under his record at that point, but 22-0 is still pretty serious. But mm-hmm. nonetheless, he actually, so what had wound up happening, however, was before that. So what kind of, according to him, set him on the wrong path was a fight in 1983 against a guy named Carlos Santana, not at all that Carlos Santana, but he sustained a broken hand while winning a decision. And he said after that fight, he was given Tylenol with codeine for his injury. And he eventually became hooked on the codeine and then started drinking liquid codeine, which is like, wowza.
Yeah.
And then went from drinking liquid codeine to eventually moving on to cocaine and crack. And according to him, after his loss to Jimmy Paul, his manager left him. His manager dropped him. And so he was offered, I guess, while he was, you know, commiserating or, you know, while he was moping around, you know, after losing his manager, mm-hmm. he was partying with some girl who offered him cocaine. He accepted. And he said within a few weeks, he was freebasing every single day.
And it's the mid-80s. So, I mean, this was like, you know, mid-late.
Stay the fuck away from cocaine. So, yeah, from cocaine to freebasing in weeks is not good. And he said that in 1984 and some of 1985, he was basically fighting solely to support his drug habit. Yeah. And so his uncle, there was a cop named Sam Williams, and his uncle basically like vouched for him in court, like pulled the judge aside and was like, you know, trying to fucking strike some deal or something. And basically after he'd gotten in trouble for theft and some other drug related stuff, and basically his uncle kind of like sponsored his comeback and his stint in rehab, Alvin Hayes, that is. The good behavior did not stick. And in late 1986, he robbed a Hazel Park party store. What the fuck is it with party stores in Detroit, bro? What is going on? Stay away from party stores. After getting in trouble for this robbery of the party store, he failed to appear in court. And that's got him sent to prison until 1993, from 1987 to 1993. Yeah, so I mean, like this gets out of hand very quickly, needless to say. And he went from fighting once when he got out of prison to then going right back for a series of robberies and staying until 2003. So he went for almost 10 years this time. And in any case, he got out of prison this time. In 2003, Emmanuel Stewart included him on a fight card or two that was scheduled to he's included him in a fight card or two at the Joe Louis Arena in Detroit that were official Kronk cards. And so that's kind of like the irony here is that he was never really an official Kronk member like that, I guess.
No. But that's why I said loosely affiliated.
But he fought on Kronk cards, and he had basically been taken under the wing of Emmanuel Stewart at the very tail end of his career.
Absolutely. And I've mentioned this article before, probably on the last Kronk show, I think it was. But Teddy Blackburn, famed photographer, that's been beat. You've seen, if you're a boxing fan, you've seen his work throughout the years. But he's originally from Detroit. Great guy. Absolutely great guy, man. Really legendary dude, knows a lot, and taking some incredible photos. Anyways, he did an article, a deep dive on visiting the Kronk in the mid 90s. This was, I have the magazine on around here, but like I'm so disorganized that I don't know where it is in my apartment. But I want to say it's from 94 after Moore beat Holyfield. So that's around the time this article came out.
Like 94-ish, yeah.
Yeah, 94-ish. So Teddy Blackburn visited the Kronk. And, you know, like I said, he's a former amateur boxer himself. So he was just, you know, familiarized himself. Runs into Booker Ward, a guy that we've mentioned Anthony Hembrick a few times.
Yeah, you just brought up Hembrick, so.
So, yeah, Booker Ward was the guy that absolutely obliterated Anthony Hembrick when Hembrick made his hometown debut and tried to pull an entire MC Hammer routine for the audience. Very, very hilarious stuff, which is on YouTube. But anyways, so while he's there, he's, you know, just talking about the various fighters. And who happened to be there? Alvin Two Sweet Hayes that day. And Hayes was training at the Kronk. So he said that they talked to him and Hayes talked about the same thing. You know, how he's been through a lot. He's trying just to get, you know, some traction in his life. No one's really trying to give him the way. And that the fact is at the Kronk, he's always felt that no one has really liked him. He's always felt like an outcast and an outsider, and he wishes people wouldn't look at him as opposed to like that. And the most striking photo is that, here's the thing about Alvin Hayes. We've talked about him. We said how he looks and how, like, you know, loud and over the top he was, kind of like a pre, you know, Camacho around the same time, but even more so at that point, because Camacho was still more mellowed out in this at that. But Alvin Hayes, we never talked about his dimensions, man. This dude was like ungainly, man. He was Tommy Hearns as a lightweight, like ridiculous, tall, the longest arms you'd ever seen. And just, you know, very, that type of guy, the same thing. He looked like a bunch of like fishing poles kind of hung together, but for whatever reason had incredible power because of it. And Teddy Blackburn took an awesome photo on the you know, the sit-up machine where you like put your feet under and you lay down like that, of Too Sweet hanging down, and he's leaning over and he has both of his arms completely elongated. And it's the long, there's good, bro. They're just long. They just look like two long just streams going out there when he's looking up at the camera.
He's definitely got that kind of Mark Breland look to him for sure.
Exactly. Totally. And so he's leaned over like that and he's looking up and stuff like that. And Blackburn mentioned, they just kind of said, you know, he kept to, he said that Hayes kept to himself and all the other fighters at the Kronk that day just kind of glanced at him at a distance, but no one approached him.
Yeah, dude. I mean, he was a troubled guy for sure. And I mean, I think that like I went over his biography and you could obviously see how he could be similar to Ricky Womack. Man, this is a rough place to grow up. This is not an easy place to grow up without a serious support system. And so, you know, some of these fighters were given this intervention by Manny Stewart and Kronk, and it worked for many of them, and some of them it just didn't work. Manny Stewart was actually going to include Hayes on another fight card on the Joe Louis Arena in February 2004. He was scheduled to appear on another card. He said that he actually had a new dance routine worked up that he was going to do for the card, an updated Michael Jackson dance routine. But unfortunately,
you know, he kind of looked like too. I mean, well, he didn't look like him, but he kind of, for whatever reason, reminded me Morris Day.
A little bit, yeah. Morris Day in the Time.
Yeah, with the whole dance routine and everything going on with him. Yeah.
Yeah, like colorful, like flashy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
A little bit. Well, he was going to do a new dance routine, but unfortunately, on January 19th, which was actually 2 years to the day after Ricky Womack died, January 19th, 2004, he died of an apparent drug overdose. I couldn't find what drug it was. I couldn't find many details about it. I would imagine it was probably cocaine, but I have no idea.
One of the magazines said that they thought it was intentional, that I read somewhere.
It would be difficult for me to dispute that. And I mean, I know it was tough. It was tough. So, I mean, anyway, I'm not going to speculate. I have no idea. But
I just honestly, it's very sad. And I want to say this. I wish there was more Alvin Hayes footage on YouTube, because I wish
he could punch. He was apparently a very talented fighter, despite the fact that, you know, both these guys, Ricky Womack and Alvin Hayes, picked up boxing later in life than a lot of fighters do. And also on top of that, you know, I mentioned it earlier, we mentioned it in that first episode about the Kronk, that they really specialized in the amateur system. That was kind of part of the draw of Kronk Gym very early on, especially, was that a lot of these fighters had been fighting for a while or had been fighting as amateurs for a while, had a lot of experience. And these two fighters were an exception to that for sure, but nonetheless were very talented.
Extremely, man. And it's sad because not just with Kronk, you can go with any type of gym in any place around there. Like, same story goes on with a lot of places, but I mean, again, you know, guys like Alvin Too Sweet Hayes or Ricky Womack and others that we've covered and stuff like that, these are just stories that we're just putting out there again for people to know, because they were talented fighters. They were very good fighters. And unfortunately, their careers got cut short for one reason or another. But we're here to tell their story now, because like, if they were able to fulfill their careers the way it should have been, everyone would be talking about them today, you know?
Yeah, within the span of a couple of years, Manny Stewart wound up having to kind of pay tribute to a couple of the fighters from Kronk. Yeah. And that fight card that Alvin Hayes was supposed to fight on wound up turning into a tribute card for him, you know, just another kind of layer of the sadness of it, I suppose. But
well, it's interesting, because if he actually would continue with that career, he probably would have stood with Stewart at that point, because where else would he would have gone? You know what I mean? Stewart, as much as he did bounce around in the 80s and whatever it was, like, and Stewart was a familiar face and someone that would have guided him. And at that point in his life and where he was trying to do his career, probably someone that he would have felt the most secure with.
Yeah, no, like no question. And that was also kind of something that Manny Stewart had done. We had mentioned in that first episode when fighters of his had gotten into trouble, he didn't just drop them.
Totally.
He didn't just say, well, you know, you're on your own. He stuck with them. He tried to get them help. Yeah. I can't speak across the board because perhaps some of them did things that were, you know, didn't merit help. But he, from almost everything I'm seeing, was sticking by his fighters and doing everything he could to set them on the straight and narrow, put them on the right path, whatever you want to call it. And some of them it just didn't take. And unfortunately, these were two fighters where it didn't take.
It's what it is, man. Story of life with this sport. Yeah.
Well, that's why we have so many episodes of the true crime shit, and why
it's I don't know if fascinating is the right word to use, but like that's what it feels like for me, you know, trying to like learn about their lives, learning about their careers, being able to tell their stories is always something I'm just like, I enjoy doing that, you know what I mean, for myself. And I'm sure you do too. That's why we do it. So
well, and I mean, you know, apart from the boxing aspect of it too, I know that you watch like true crime programs and.
Dude, the only reason why I still have cable is because I watch Discovery ID. If there's a way I can like get that without having cable, I would do it in a heartbeat.
And I don't watch a lot of that stuff, but I do watch some of it. I do every so often watch some like, you know, cold case stuff and stuff like that. And also I just have in general.
Cold Case Files was that show, man. That and American Justice.
The A&E show.
I used to narrate it. Bill Miller. Bill Curtis. That was his name. Bill Curtis, something like that. But he had the best voice, and the way he just narrated was perfect. Yeah.
In this sleepy Illinois town. Yeah, it was I watch some of that stuff too, and it's fascinating to me. And also like psychology, criminal psychology in general, also fascinating.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and like I said at the beginning, it's not that we're celebrating it and it's not that we're getting our kicks off of it or anything like that, but it's just something we like to explore, remember, make sure that people know the whole story. And that's at least part of it for me too, is that people move on, at least have some more facts rather than just the rumors and repeat
repeat things that are not true. And what you just hear on the thing, oh, so-and-so was a bad guy and he was a drug addict and blah blah blah. Nah, there's always a bunch of side and layers to this story, man. Give everybody a whole piece of how they got to where they did. All right.
Well, and that's why it's important to me to get into a little bit of the biography so that people understand that like this is not just like some fucking rich kid who blah blah blah. You know, these people are coming up rough. A lot of the people we're talking about in these true crime episodes are coming up rough, I should say.
Totally. With all that said, the next guy that we're discussing now. From a lot of people I've discussed with, I've talked to Emmanuel Stewart, I've talked to Sugar Hill, I've talked to Tommy Hearns, and they all universally agreed that he was the baddest man to ever come out of the Kronk gym. And, you know, not surprisingly, his nickname was Super Bad. Talking about Bernard Mays.
Yeah, Bernard Super Bad Mays, dude. And I mean, like, that's an era too with the late 1970s and early 1980s for middleweights. Like, you know, right in the thick of it. Like, you know, I don't want to say it was a transitional era, because it was like you had Marvin Hagler, obviously, but you had the transition from Monzon to Hagler. But then, like, you had a lot of the action going on at welterweight, too. So, I mean, like, you know, it's a fun era to talk about.
It is. And like you said, the era between Monzon to Hagler's coronation. That's not an era that's talked about a lot, man. Like, because it's kind of forgetful. You know what I mean? You had Hugo Coro, Rodrigo Valdez. Once Monzon retired, Valdez kind of fell off the wayside. And so he lost to Coro, Vito Interfermo, Alan Minter. You know, it's more or less a forgettable era. But Bernard Mays was, you know, probably the biggest what if you can imagine. If there's not much footage of him out there. There's really not. I know there's something on YouTube that like surfaced recently within the past year or so, but you can tell he's, you know, from all descriptions, it's kind of past it at this point. But like from everyone that I've talked to, from Emmanuel Stewart to Tommy Hearns, who sparred with him countless times, to Sugar Hill, who's carrying on the Kronk legacy, to anyone else affiliated with that gym. Bernard Superbad Mays might have been the best, absolute peak, just pound for pound, the best Kronk fighter that ever stepped in that gym. And that is saying something. I mean, when you think of that, like, that's just mind-blowing to think of, considering the level of talent that's come through that gym. But another thing that should be said too, and I'm, you know, I'll let you add on to this, Emmanuel Stewart used to say that Bernard Mays was the first fighter that he started from scratch and kind of built for himself, like his own personal project. Like, this was his own, like, you know, building a Frankenstein type of deal, right?
I yes, and I don't really know that much about his upbringing. Like, I don't really know too much about
his. No, neither do I. From what I, not to cut you off, but like, please. Is that, like, the story from, and this off the top of my head, the story is that, like, Stewart was, you know, he was training, he was still laying the amateur scene. This was the year before before Tommy Hearns and Ken T and others came on the pro scene. But, like, Stewart was still, you know, building his thing. And at this point, like you said, the Kronk Rec Center, not just the boxing gym, but, like, they had a lot of things going on. The kids would go there and, you know, do various activities.
Yeah, it was almost like an after school. Yeah.
Yeah, like when I used to go to the Boys and Girls Club when I was a kid. Totally, totally. Because the Boys and Girls Club offered boxing when my old trainer, who had a long history in New England and amateur boxing in general, and he held his gym and he was an elder statesman. But I used to go play bowling. I was playing pool, whatever, you know, everything else. When Emmanuel Stewart, who was, you know, working with the Kronk at that point, went over there to go just wander around one day, he found Bernard Mays, correct me if I'm wrong, with his friend swimming, correct?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. And asked him, hey, are you guys interested in learning how to box? And Mays, you know, agreed and took to it. And then from there, they started this relationship. But Mays was a kid when Stewart found it.
And he, by the time he was in his early teens, he was already, like, almost prodigious. You know, he's a prodigy.
Yes, totally. Yeah. And Stewart said this was his project. He started him from the ground up just, and, you know, how did he, I watched Rocky One the other day on the train, on the plane going to Al Austin. So what did Mickey say? I want to take all this knowledge and give it to you. Right. That's kind of what Stewart did with Bernard Mays. He had everything he'd had from his amateur career, everything like that. And just kind of poured everything yet because it was the summertime. He said it was kind of quiet. A lot of kids weren't really trying to be in a gym. They wanted to be outside, but Mays went to him and he was able to, you know, to cultivate that. Like, this is his pet project. And he just built him from the ground up, man. And it's just like,
it's not the best analogy, but I did think about this the other day and it kind of reminded me, like, when reading a little bit about Superbad Mays and his story, it reminds me a little bit of Nipper Pat Daly. And again, yes, like, it's not the same.
The child prodigy, right?
Yeah. Because, I mean, like, you go look up Nipper Pat Daly's story for anybody who's listening or watching. It's pretty wild, dude. If I just tell you.
I actually learned about him from you, I think, in your earlier posts and like the early days of Twitter when with the boxing history stuff. Because I think you did like a deep dive on him, didn't you?
I've posted about it, yeah. Well, like a dude named, I think his name's Alex Daly, who was like his like great, great nephew or grandnephew or, you know, some sort of whatever.
Yeah. Deep lineage somewhere.
Yeah. He's some sort of relation to him, wrote a book about Nipper Pat Daly. And then there's been a website and the whole point is I'll sum it up in a way that makes it sound the craziest, even though it's true. This dude turned pro when he was like 9 years old and was totally fucking washed up by the time he was 16 or 17. Nipper Pat Daly, that is. And so that's kind of, and the whole like story goes is that he was like, you know, fighting grown men, fighting whatever. And, but it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
There's no lie to it. So go look that up. And anyway, Superbad Mays kind of, the story reminds me a little bit of that. Just because he was supposedly so good at such a young age, you know, at only 14 years old, he was, let's see, it says right here, he swept to victory in the 106-pound class, the National Junior Olympic Tournament. 2 years later, repeated in the 139-pound division. He fought more than 200 times as an amateur. He lost only once. I mean, and it's difficult to substantiate amateur records. Keep that in mind. You know, most of them are self-reported. Most of them are, you know, like they don't keep track of that like that.
Because you're not really sure what's a smoker, what's considered a smoker, or just like
right. that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what counts, what doesn't count. Totally. And on top of that, how many years or decades or whatever have people been talking about Ray Robinson never lost as an amateur, but it's like you can go boom, 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 boom. These are his losses right here. They're in the newspaper. You know, it's like, anyway, a lot of amateur records are self-reported. So take them with a grain of salt. It's more the bulk that's important. You know, like not, he fought 200 times and his record was 200. No, like that's not even, the record's not important. It's the fact that he fought 200 times. Like that's fucking wild. So anyway, he had an extensive amateur career and was an incredible amateur, except for by the time he was 16 and he had won that 139 pound tournament, he was literally already on the verge of alcoholism and was drinking. And even so, even after
he had an affinity for Old English, from what I read.
Yeah, it was over here. It says Colt 45.
Oh, one of them. I don't know.
Either way,
I've dabbled.
Either way,
we've all dabbled with them back in the day, man.
It's about the same, dude. It's roughly the same. They're both malt liquor. They'll both fuck you up. They both taste like absolute shit. They're both dirt cheap. Like it's King Cobra, Mickey's, same shit. The exact same shit, you know. So but yeah, and then like the other layer to this kind of story is right around the same time, supposedly Tommy Hearns had just won the national AAU title, and Superbad Mays, the reason why Tommy Hearns' nose looks like it does even now is that Superbad Mays crushed his nose in the gym during a sparring session one day.
Yes,
not long after Tommy Hearns had won the title.
Nope. So when I met Tom, the one time I had a one-on-one with Tommy Hearns is when he got inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame. And anytime, because again, you know me, like,
did you do the fist casting?
Yeah, back then I did.
Oh my, on Tommy Hearns?
On Tommy Hearns, I did.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. That you just, your hand touched a perfectly assembled lethal weapon. Yes.
Like, I completely got it ready and coded it up ready for it to be, like, casted. And we talked for it, and when the thing is, when I did the fist casting, wild, I was dude. The one who was like, why the Vaseline the hands up? So it's like, besides the person who actually held the hand in there for a while to like cast it, I was like the second in charge in terms of
you're getting intimate. You're getting in there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to definitely ask my questions. So besides giving the pleasantries, hey, man, you're one of my favorites. I love you. Blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah, right. About- you're like in 1976 on November 1st.
No, literally one of the very first fights I remember ever watching with my dad is, and what made me like get all excited was that, like, to see his eyes light up when Tommy Hearns was on TV. Because remember how you would talk about how you and I talked about how like Hearns appeared randomly on a couple of like Chavez or just like pay-per-view, Don King pay-per-view undercards in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. So I remember one of them I watched, my dad was one of the first pay-per-views I watched with him, and Tommy Hearns was on. And he opened up the fight and opened up the show. And my dad had no idea. He was like, oh, man, wow, this is Tommy Hearns, blah, 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 blah. And he was all excited. Like, I would be for wrestling, so I got excited too. And he was like, Harris, watch. He knocks everybody out in the first round or just right around there. You're going to see, boom, boom. And he ended up knocking out, I think it was Dan Ward, poor guy, just blasted him in the first round. And then when I watched that, I was excited too. I was like, whoa, wow, man, you know. And he held his hands up and I was throwing punches and all that. So Hearns became one of my favorites automatically. But fast forward all these years later, I'm at the Hall of Fame. So we're talking about that. And then I bring up Superbad Mays. Because anybody I know that's affiliated with the Kronk or affiliated with Detroit and would know about him, I just want to know because it's fascinating to me. Like, here's a guy, there's almost no footage of him. And there is footage out there, like, but it's kind of like Gypsy Joe Harris. It's not out there. You know what I mean? You know there's footage, but there's only like a blip of the person on YouTube or something. But like the meat and potatoes that you really know will show them at their full powers, that you're just like, it's not out there. So I want to know. I want to pick your brain. Tell me about him. Were you around? Do you know him? Whatever. So obviously Tommy Hearns, like you said, he got his nose busted by him. So we knew him quite well. So I asked him about him. I was like, yo, man, you know, Bernard Mays, can you tell me something? And Hearns got this big smile on his face. He wrapped his arm around me. He was like, yo, man, that was my man. I love that guy to death. you know, he was amazing, yada, yada, yada. And he also said, too, he was like, you whipped my ass. Like, you know, Hayes, Hearns didn't tell me this personally, but I've read in other accounts, Hayes used to beat him so bad that Hearns questioned if he should continue boxing from there. That's how good Bernard Mays was at one point, man. Like, and Pat, here's the thing too, man, that's kind of mind blowing. Like you said, he was already at the cusp of alcoholism as a teenager. By the time at this point, he was like, you know, when his amateur career was ending and he was turning pro, he was already like full blown into that. He was wrecked. He was way past his best.
Dude, beer is like the worst pot. Like, it's just so many, carbs and calories. Like, you could just drink beer, vodka, like, or...
It's one thing to be drinking Bud Light, and I'm not much of a beer drinker, but it's one thing to be drinking that stuff.
Yeah, just drinking straight up malt liquor.
40s, bro.
40s, yeah, straight up malt liquor.
I used to drink 40s when, like, I, back in the day when I was.
That's like all you can get.
Totally.
Because you're underage.
Like, I drew a taste for oldie in the day, and I like Colt 45. I couldn't drink that shit today, but back then, totally.
Yeah, dude, you drink that shit with this look on your face, you'd be like, you'd choke it down. I know. I remember. We've all been there. But totally. Oh, bro. But like, as far as like an athlete, you know what I'm saying? Like a world just, class. Would, like that's like the like worst said, fucking you know, thing.
Yeah, man. And it broke him down, and it's sad, man, because like he had such a stellar amateur career, and he looked so good, and he was whooping everyone in the gym, and he was and everyone like he's at this point of like. Mythical proportions even before he turns pro, and then like by the time he turns pro, he's past it, you know. It's already been established that he has issues, that like, you know, he has issues with the bottle and other various things going on, but he still has like a pretty good pro career going on. Like, he still runs his record up to a very, you know, dominating everyone that he fights at that point,
which says, well, it says a couple things. I think it says a lot about his talent for sure. Mm-hmm. Because he got to the record that he got to. He won it was like 39 or 40 straight fights or something, like, or whatever it was. He won a number of fights in a row, and I mean, part of that was his talent, part of it was that a lot of the fighters he was fighting just sucked, their records were not good. That was also part of it, but it
wonder what he fought a draw with was tough though. Ted Sanders.
That's true.
That dude was actually a legit guy. He gave Alex Ramos his first loss, and he gave everyone else hell. But
there
like,
were a couple yeah, of fighters couple. That he fought that were pretty, actually pretty good, but not that many.
Totally.
And I think that the other thing that makes it a little bit more impressive, and I think speaks to his talent, is the fact that he dropped Manny Stewart as he turned pro. When yep. he turned pro, he had broke from Manny Stewart because Manny Stewart wouldn't stop, you know, getting on him about drinking, because he would apparently disappear. He'd like, you know, just he wouldn't come train. And so he'd go drink, and then it would be like he'd like the study the night before the test. Like, you know, he'd come in last minute and train and get in shape for the fight and go fight. But then finally, when he went to go turn pro, I don't know the entire story, but I could hear Manny Stewart probably saying some shit like, you're not ready. You know, like you need to get stop drinking if you're going to turn pro. And he was probably like, fuck that. Didn't want to stop drinking, and he didn't stop drinking. So he turned pro. I don't remember who it was that he had gotten with. I looked at some point, but he had gotten with somebody else when he turned pro and fought under their guidance for a handful of years. But drank literally the entire time, and that took its toll.
You know, it really did, man. And they said, obviously, with his one loss, that what happened was that he doubled over in pain from, like, you know, getting hit in the body at one point like that. And they realized that, like, his body, from all the drinking that he had been doing, being an alcoholic, like, just taking one shot to the gut over there, just had him like kind of ruptured his, not ruptured, but like completely, you know, took him out.
Yeah. He had like, he had pancreatitis. He had inflammation of the pancreas.
So he had no business being in the ring at the first.
No. Point. Yeah. Like he either they weren't doing blood work or something, because I would imagine that, that for the most part, the, organ damage that he apparently incurred would have been picked up by blood work. But also, you know, we've talked about this on other shows too, where we talked, where I mentioned Mancini Kim and how that was the turning point. It was not to get on too much of a tangent here, but Mancini Kim was really the catalyst for electroencephalograms, EEG, brain scans prior to fights, for title fights for, I believe it was the WBA first and then the WBC. But in any case, they made it the norm. But it, even so, you know, like blood work, they can't afford to get blood work done for like every fighter who fights. Are you kidding me? Otherwise fights wouldn't happen. So, you know, I imagine they probably didn't pick that up and shit, but yeah, he wound up having inflammation of the pancreas and severe liver damage from all the drinking that he had done over the years. And so that led to him having to stop fighting. And gosh, I'd have to bring up his thing real quick here. In 1985, November of 1985, is his single loss by second round knockout to a dude named Matthew Lewis at the Forum in Inglewood.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's fairly unceremonious. He never really got in with anybody who was a serious ranked contender beyond Ted Sanders. Wasn't like a ranked contender, but he was a good kind of journeyman.
And he beat also level fighter. He beat Shotgun Oscar Alvarado, who was he beat a former junior middleweight champion. But by that time, Alvarado was completely cooked himself. So
right, like I'm not sure how much that actually earned him, you know.
That's just the name on the record at that point. Totally. But you know what's sad too is that again, Ring Magazine coming in. This is how you learn about these guys. I learned about him from this. Well, you know, what part is it that they always do? I think like either round one or one of those parts of the magazine that they had it, and they had a little obituary. Well, no, it wasn't obituary. It was just it was like the blurb where they give you the outside of the news, like all the bad stuff that happened. So and so got arrested. This one's happening with this. Blah blah blah. Blah.
Yeah.
You know, outside the ropes.
I know. Yeah. I think that's what it was.
Outside the ropes.
You're right.
Outside
the ropes.
Yes. So, at that point, they had a photo of Mays knocking, fighting Ted Sanders. And it said, too, that like they mentioned that he had passed away. And I think they said they withered to like 80 pounds at that point. That is dead. Like, yeah, I think he had like, you know, like a bloated belly and just everything. Like, oh, man, this is tragic. Absolutely tragic. Yeah. And it's crazy to think, man, because like I mentioned, I've talked to Tommy Hearns. When I talked to Emmanuel Stewart, I put up photos. I've mentioned this before. You've mentioned this, bro. Like anybody who ever met Emmanuel Stewart, rest in peace. If you had a chance to talk to him, he would talk your ear off. He didn't care who you were. All right. He was just a lovable person who wanted to talk boxing with anybody. And, you know, I didn't want to talk about Lennox Lewis or the normal stuff. I wanted to know about Superbad Mays and some of his other guys. So I would talk about that. And the smile that he got on his face, like bringing back memories and talking about how good he was and what he was able to do.
Cause that's like asking somebody, and that's like even just asking it, like it's like you're like letting them know, like you're a real one. Like,
yeah, okay, yeah, all right. For sure. Totally, totally. And thank God my dad was there to like cover when I was talking to Stewart a few times, because he would always get like, you know, you could see the look on his face. He was just like really, really reminiscent and happy about it. And it wasn't any sadness. There was like no hint of sadness or whatever. Like he was like almost proud of what he was able to build with it, you know? And the fact that the guy is like a crunk legend up until this day, that's like, you know, everybody knows, hey man, super bad. You know what I mean? Like that name still holds recognition. And then years later, when I used to work a lot of Adonis Stevenson fights, you know, for CompuBox and actually, you know, be covering for it.
Yeah. A lot of people forget that he was with Kronk.
He was, yeah, he was, a, yeah. Before Emmanuel Stewart died, you would see him in the corner with him, and then Sugar Hill took over. But yes, totally. And I don't remember what fight it was. It might have been Tony Bellew. It might have been a different one, whatever it was. But we were on the same flight. We got off together. We were walking. And then I asked him, too. He's holding, Sugar Hill decked out head to toe in Kronk gear, has the Kronk bag on him and everything. And I was like, oh, man, can I just ask you a question? And he was like, yeah, go ahead. I was like, Superbad Mays, how good was he? He looked at me, he smiled, he goes, he was the best. He's absolutely the best. Ain't no one messing with him. And I was like, really?
That's so crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like the talent that's come through Kronk, and then for somebody to say that, like, you know, unequivocally.
And for a guy like Hill, too, who's like younger than Stewart and like has seen everything that come through, and like he didn't even hesitate, bro. He didn't hesitate. Right away, he smiled and said he was the absolute best. he said he was the absolute best. And yeah, I was like,
nuts, dude.
I was like, is there footage of him? He said, yeah, I got some tapes. But, you know, and I was like, and I'm just sitting there like, you know, like a cartoon character with my tongue hanging out. Like, I want to know more. Tell me, please.
Send me these tapes, sir.
Yeah, anything.
That's my
Harry Dreb almost like, but nah, man, that was so cool to see that. Like, he's held in such high regard. So it's sad to see what happened, but I mean, like, think of the legacy that he still left.
After he was forced to stop fighting because he had so much organ damage, he had to go live with his mom, and then his mom wound up passing away. And he was sent to live in a nursing home in Detroit, when the nursing home is where he wound up dying in 1994. He wound up going into cardiac arrest because his organs just couldn't work anymore. And so I mean, like, he died a very early death, super untimely death, unfortunately, because of his alcoholism. And I think that he was buried in an unmarked grave. I'm not sure if he still is. Not sure if that's ever been taken care of. But, you know, that's unfortunately also just another one of those legacies from 100 years earlier of fighters dying destitute and being put in an unmarked grave.
Yeah, man. You know, and there's been times over the years with a lot of organizations, thankfully, they've been able to rectify that.
John DeSanto, Philly Boxing History, has done a number of them. I think Ring 8 has done a couple of them.
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
I remember King Gavilan got his got a proper grave. Tyrone Everett got a proper grave. I want to say Gypsy Joe Harris was another one.
What was the old timey one? I want to say it was Young Griffo,
he might be right. Yeah.
Who was, I want to say his grave was paid for by, gosh, dude, I might be getting my wires crossed here. But anyway, yeah, it's a nice little tradition.
Yeah, I know that, like, Hank Kaplan used to be heavily involved in things like that as well back in his day, the great historian. You know, like, it's good when boxing's old timer, when boxing's legit, like, fans, you know, and historians come together and try to, like, you know, make things right. So.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that is a good part of the tradition is that between the International Boxing Research Organization and just the subculture of history folks in boxing, that's definitely one of the good aspects of it, is that often we're able to kind of pool together and it's unfortunate that a lot of these fighters wind up meeting a similar end. And Super Bad Mays never really even got the chance to put forth what these other fighters did. You know, he left Kronk, left Stewart,
and
that was kind of his undoing, apart from the alcohol too.
Totally. And again, he's probably the biggest what if, you know, considering how everybody talks about him, and anyone from that time period. I'm sure his name has been passed on. The stories have been passed on throughout the decades to all the other generations. Hell, I bet you if you ask Tyson Fury, if you know who Super Bad Mays is, I'm sure he knows
the story. He might, yeah.
Absolutely. He has to. You know, it's that type of thing. And it makes you wonder if he was able to control his vices, or, you know, other different circumstances, what he was able to accomplish. Because if he was able to hold the same way he did as an amateur, you know, into the pro ranks. Because again, as a pro, look what we did. We looked at his record and you see how successful he was, albeit like not the toughest competition. But like still,
but that
he was
like
a full blown alcoholic during his pro career, and he was like still able to do it. You know,
but middleweight, it like the late 80s and shit, dude. That's he could have been in that. He could have been in on that
easily. Mid to late 80s after, yeah,
no question. After Hagler was out and Ray Leonard was basically not in, yeah, dude, he could have been in on that, no question.
Yep,
man. Oh, dude, you know, Kronk has so much history behind it. So many great fighters have gone through Kronk Gym in Detroit. And obviously, for the most part, the fighters that we've talked about thus far, they don't really fall under that umbrella of like great fighters. But nonetheless, you know, they have their own stories. They deserve to be remembered. And this kind of tradition, you know, it's the tradition of Kronk Gym serving the community. You know, there's all sorts of stories, and
totally,
they need to be told.
And that's what we're here for.
Totally, man. Hey, dude. Well, I appreciate it because once more, we were able to tell a couple more stories that generally aren't going to get told. So I appreciate it, dude. I know you did your homework and I tried to do mine.
Oh, yeah, we both did our stuff, man. You know, and I'm hopefully that we did these guys justice. Obviously, man, seriously, rest in peace to them too, man, because these are all just fallen soldiers that deserve that their names deserve to be remembered. You know what I mean? They're not as popular as some of the other names, you know, that everybody knows throughout history, but doesn't mean that they don't deserve to be remembered and talked about. So
totally, 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody who stuck with us this entire time, we do appreciate you. If you listened in via any of the podcast apps, please do subscribe, leave us a comment. Those things are appreciated for sure. If you watched on YouTube, thank you so much. Also, subscribe on YouTube, reply with comments, questions. I mean, if we can, we'd be happy to get to them and stuff. So yeah, also, as far as social media goes, Knuckles and Gloves Podcast is on both Facebook and Instagram. We're also on Twitter. Individually, we're on Twitter too. Eris is on Twitter as Punch Zone Eris. Me, Patrick, I'm there as Patrick M. Connor. So please follow us there and say hello. Eris, we'll talk soon, bro.
Absolutely, man. Take care, everybody.
Later, everybody.